The watch supervisor nodded. Man overboard. Understood. He passed the call to the command duty officer in the Joint Harbor Operations Center on the other side of the frosted glass wall. The CDO, Chief Petty Officer George Rodriguez, assigned a Jayhawk operations specialist named Sally Fry to monitor the call through Rescue 21, an advanced maritime C-4, computing, command, control, and communications program. Rescue 21 used a variety of fixed towers to vector the ship's position each time it transmitted, superimposing a line of position on a digital chart. Best-case scenario, the transmission hit multiple towers and took the search out of search and rescue. But even one tower would put the distressed vessel somewhere along that given line. In a calm but authoritative voice, belying her junior status and 23 years of age, Petty Officer Fry engaged the young man at the other end of the radio in a conversation, during which he said little but "man overboard" and "please to help." Both the Straits operator and the operations specialist were female, and the transfer went so smoothly that the person reporting the mayday never knew he'd been passed from vessel traffic services to the rescue management side of the Jayhawk house. A time clock began the moment the command duty officer became aware of the distress call. Chief Rodriguez looked across his workstation and nodded at the operations unit specialist, who returned the nod, letting the chief know he was already building a case in search and rescue optimal planning system. Among many other nuanced factors, SEROPS accounted for pre-distress vessel movement, present wind speed, and water currents, generating an estimated location of the vessel when rescue assets arrived. Next, Rodriguez picked up the phone and activated Air Station Port Angeles to spin up their B-0 response crew and get the ready helo flying toward Orion. Anyone watching the process might have thought the call happened simultaneously with his other actions, and they would not be far from wrong. As command duty officer, Chief Rodriguez had the authority to send assets before even notifying his boss, the search and rescue mission coordinator. The SMC made it crystal clear. When it came to SAR, the initial response of the U.S. Coast Guard was to go there. The junior duty officer at Coast Guard Air Station Port Angeles answered the phone on the first ring. CDO Rodriguez passed on the information to the JDO, who repeated it back, then hung up and pressed the extension for the senior duty officer, Lieutenant Commander Andrew Slosnick, pilot in command of the B-0 response helicopter. Each Coast Guard air station in the United States had at least one B-0 response crew on duty at any given time. They slept next to the hangar and were ready to deploy inside a 30-minute window. Each SDO had his or her own way of doing things, and this one liked to be called prior to the SAR launch alarm being activated. The SDO answered quickly for so early in the morning. "This is Mr. Slosnick," he said, his words thick with sleep. The pilots were accustomed to these middle-of-the-night calls. Lieutenant Commander Slosnick seemed to live for them. The JDO relayed the scant information regarding Orion's man overboard report, and the SDO repeated it back to assure the petty officer he was awake and moving. "Let's go ahead and wake up the crew," he added, before hanging up. The SAR alarm wailed a moment later, resting his co-pilot, Lieutenant Becky Crum, from a deep sleep in the adjacent room. Slosnick called her cell phone just to make sure she heard the siren, and said in his best Arnold Schwarzenegger voice, "Get to the chopper!" The flight mechanic and rescue swimmer slept in a building closer to the hangar and nearer to the alarm. Slosnick splashed cold water on his face and smoothed the bedhead out of his dark hair. He sat on the edge of his rack while he pulled up local weather and any notices to airmen on the electronic flight bag program on his iPad. Winds gusting to 40 with heavy rain in the strait. He groaned. As a helicopter pilot, he didn't mind the wind. In fact, wind helped him with his hover when the bird was heavy, but it wreaked havoc on the hoist cable and made the rescue swimmer's job all the more difficult. And his swimmer on this crew was a newbie, fresh out of 13 weeks training. They'd gone out earlier that day on a jumper from the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, but locals had fished the body on before they got there, so it wasn't a real call-out. The kid had handled himself well, asked good questions during the CRM open conversation Sloznik encouraged during any mission. This was going to be different. The kid was going to get wet. The weather was skosh, but it was a good thing he was going to cut his teeth on a simple man-in-the-water operation. First-hand experience in cold water cajoled the SDO along in his routine. People who fell off ships rarely wore any sort of protective suit, and without any protection, the window for survival began to close at an extremely rapid rate. Sloznik would check the weather again before he launched. Marginal weather at the station often sucked severely farther west in the strait. He pushed a speed dial number on his cell and made his first call the ops boss at home, holding the phone to his ear with a shoulder while he stepped into his Switlik trisuit. It was a goofy thing, and he didn't admit it to anyone other than his wife. But he loved that orange suit. Wearing it along with the black SAR Warrior survival vest made him feel like a superhero. He didn't mind getting up in the middle of the night. Like his 5-year-old son said, that's when superheroes were needed the most. Andy Sloznik had known he would someday become a pilot from the moment he saw his first crop duster growl overhead to drop a marker at the end of a row on 400 acres of canola at his grandfather's farm. He was 9 years old, and his family had been visiting his mother's parents in southern Alberta. The Piper Pawnee Brave had seemed low enough to reach up and touch. Andy begged his granddad to make the hour drive to the Lethbridge City Library, where he checked out as many books on aviation as he could fit in his scrawny arms, and then devoured them all in 3 days. His room back in Boise became a gallery of plastic models, and he bored his friends to tears with an intricate and ever-growing knowledge of each and every aircraft that hung from the spackled ceiling on bits of sewing thread. An uncanny memory and a natural knack for math worked in concert to give Sloznik an SAT score of 1464. Midway through his junior year, he began the lengthy application process to both the United States Air Force Academy and the United States Military Academy at West Point. His GPA, superior SAT score, and a sub-2-minute 800-meter time on his high school track team got him accepted to week-long programs at each school during the summer break before he was a senior. The Air Force liaison from nearby Mountain Home AFB took one look at the boy's stats and pushed him hard to keep his sights firmly fixed on a wild blue U. But a guidance counselor suggested he might consider the Coast Guard Academy. She told him that because of its smaller class size, the USCGA was considered more selective. She then said maybe he should forget it. It might be a great deal of work with such a slim chance of being accepted. The challenge alone appealed to Andrew's competitive nature. He liked to prove he could excel at the hard stuff. He knew that the Navy and the Coast Guard both had aircraft, and some hotshot pilots, but they also had boats. A lot of boats. Andrew didn't want to do boats. He wanted to fly. And besides, the Air Force liaison kept reminding him that if he ever wanted to be an astronaut, he needed to go with the Zoomies. In the end, it was the guidance counselor's thrown gauntlet that found Andrew Sloznik sitting with a class of 34 other AIM summer program cadet wannabes in New London, Connecticut, listening to various old-timers answer questions about their respective jobs. The discussion was informative enough, but there was far too much talk about boats. Andrew found his mind wandering, thinking about how cool it would be to tell his friends he was an astronaut. And then a tall, gangly, red-headed MH-65 Dolphin helicopter pilot took the microphone. He'd been last on the program, and looking back, Andrew understood why. None of the other pros wanted to follow this guy. The pilot regaled the eager young students with stories of killer winds and night flights over mountainous seas. To hear this guy tell it, he got into hairy situations every other day. It was Andrew who asked the final question of the night, and even as he spoke, he felt his mind drift again, pondering what the guys at Colorado Springs had to offer him. Surely the Air Force had hundreds of pilots with swagger and stories like this guy. Andrew stood to ask the question. "Sir," he said, "how many people would you say you've saved over the course of your career?" The red-headed chopper pilot was a lieutenant commander, probably in his early 30s, still a few years away from making O5, where he'd be forced into grad school and flying a desk more than his bird. He listened to the question, then leaned back in his chair and stared at the ceiling for a few seconds, moving his fingers over his thumb as if counting. After a moment, he looked up at Andrew and clarified, "Do you mean pulled some retired granddad with a bad case of food poisoning off a cruise ship, or literally plucked somebody from the jaws of a watery death?" The cadet wannabes all chuckled. "Let's go with plucked from the jaws of death," Andrew said, thinking maybe he'd hit a nerve. The pilot gave a humble shrug. 37, he said. The room grew quiet as a church. Andrew Slosnick returned to Boise, where later that year he received congressional nominations for both USAFA and West Point. He was formally accepted to each school. The Air Force Academy sent an early admission letter in an effort to preempt him from accepting another offer. But 5 weeks after he graduated high school, and to the chagrin of the Air Force liaison from Mountain Home, his parents dropped him in New London, Connecticut for reporting day, colloquially called R-Day, at the United States Coast Guard Academy. Cadet Slosnick memorized every word of Reef Points, the pocket-sized cadet Bible of Coast Guard general knowledge, gritted his teeth through the 7-week horror show of Swab Summer, and plowed through the rest of his freshman year. 4 years later, after learning not to be such a self-important ass, he graduated third from the top of his class with a degree in mechanical engineering and a tolerance for boats. With a fresh set of ensign boards on his shoulders, Slosnick's academic standing opened the door to flight school, and after a battery of rigorous physical tests and an in-depth background where OPM investigators asked with complete sincerity if his mother's family had ever urged him to spy for the Canadians, he was admitted to rotary wing training at Naval Air Station Pensacola. He finished up training in his Coast Guard airframe in Mobile, Alabama. And even now, Lieutenant Commander Andrew Slosnick got chills every time he walked with a swagger out to the flight line and his own MH-65 Dolphin, because few weeks went by that he didn't have an opportunity to pluck someone from the jaws of death. Chapter 4. Dressed in his orange dry suit, Lieutenant Commander Slosnick logged into the Aviation Logistics Management Information System across from the watch captain's desk to check maintenance records. The air station had 3 MH-65s, but it was a rare moment when at least one wasn't undergoing some kind of maintenance. The Coast Guard seemed to operate under the have 3 to make 1 rule when it came to helicopters. In this case, 2 birds were operational, so Slosnick flipped a coin and signed out 6521. He made a second call to the ops boss, who'd already touched bases with Jayhawk, and been informed there was also a 47-foot response boat out of Nia Bay near the mouth of the strait, responding to the mayday. Co-pilot Lieutenant Becky Crum was already outside doing the pre-flight and starting the helo. She was quick and efficient, which was good, because now that he knew surface assets were on the way, Slosnick's competitive nature kicked into high gear. He knew the boat crews in Nia Bay, and they were every bit as competitive. Not a bad thing, really. The guy in the water didn't much care who got there first. 18 minutes from the JDO's call, the two pilots walked through a steady rain and climbed into their orange bird, sometimes called Tupper Wolf or Plastic Fantastic by other, less discerning pilots, and began their instrument checks. Slosnick preferred to sit in the left seat and run the radios while he flew, but Crum was new and not yet hoist-qualified, so Slosnick took the right side. The flight mech and rescue swimmer got themselves situated in the back. 8 minutes after that, Slosnick flipped down his Anviz 9 night vision goggles and called Whidbey Island Approach to request clearance to take off to the west, advising them he had information Bravo. With flight clearance given, He added throttle and pulled up the collective to bring the Dolphin into a hover. The 70-mile-per-hour rotor wash drove the rain into the ever-present goose crap on the runway, throwing it into the upwash and spattering green slime across the windscreen. "That is so nasty," Lieutenant Crum muttered, before depressing the microphone and transmitting to the Jayhawk. "Rescue 6521 departing Air Station Port Angeles with four souls on board. ETA Pillar Point, 14 minutes. Lieutenant Commander Slosnick checked with the rest of his crew, who each gave him a thumbs up. 6521's tail came up slightly and she shuddered, like a racehorse in the gates. "Gauges in the green," Slosnick said, performing one final scan of his instruments an instant before he eased the cyclic forward to scoot down the runway. "This looks, smells, and feels like a helicopter. We're on the go." In the rearmost seat of Rescue 6521, mounted almost flush to the deck, rescue swimmer Lance Kitchen checked his gear for the second time since boarding the aircraft. He was 5'10", 172 pounds. At 24, and a recent graduate of the monumentally strenuous 13-week Coast Guard Rescue Swimmer School in Elizabeth City, North Carolina, he was in the best shape of his life. The darkness was nothing to him now. Dangling on a spinning cable above an angry sea was second nature. Black water and big waves called his name. What he feared was failure. More specifically, any failure brought about because of something he missed. Unlike the other members of the SAR crew, Petty Officer Second Class Kitchen's gear reflected the fact that he planned to get in the water. A scuba mask and snorkel were affixed to the top of his windsurfing helmet, along with a strobe that would allow the pilots to keep him in sight in heavy seas. His black Triton swimmer vest harness contained, among other things, a regulator and small pony bottle of air, a Benchmade automatic knife, a 405 personal locator beacon, and a waterproof ICOM radio with an earpiece. An EMT paramedic, he'd leave the bulk of his trauma gear on the chopper to utilize once he got the guy in the basket and hoisted him up. Heavy rubber jet fins hung from a clip on his high-visibility orange DUI dry suit. He'd slip them on when they got to the scene, just before he attached himself to the hoist. With the gear and mindset checks complete, Kitchen sat back in his seat and looked at the Seiko dive watch on his wrist. 11 minutes out. One man in the water. Simple. He could do this. Tilda Peterson, the captain of Ocean Treasure, was on the bridge when she heard Orion's initial Mayday broadcast on 22 Alpha, the communications channel with Seattle VTS. The luxury cruise ship was returning from a 25-day round-trip cruise to Hawaii. She was making 24 knots in order to pick up her pilot near Port Angeles and make her berthing time of 0700. She put a pair of blue marine binoculars to her eyes and looked at the orange glow on the water ahead. "Man overboard," she repeated, half to herself. "Captain," Alberto said, "the radar shows what appear to be multiple small craft suddenly in the water." Peterson lowered the binoculars. "Small craft? How many?" "At least 30 by my count. They completely surround the Orion. I would guess she's losing containers overboard." "A fair assessment." Peterson studied the multiple blips on the radar. They looked like a swarm of silver dots around the much larger vessel. An orange glow now filled the horizon ahead. Peterson's binoculars went back up to her eyes. "Alberto," she said, "keep a weather eye for floating containers, but bring us up to best speed. That ship is on fire." 14 miles to the east of Ocean Treasure, Slosnick and Crum flipped up their NVGs at the sudden brightness in front of their helicopter. "Holy shit," Kitchen said, surveying the conflagration in the water ahead. "Man overboard my ass," the flight mech said, nose pressed to the helicopter's window as they made a tight circle over the carnage. The bulbous bow of the container ship pointed upward, while the stern was completely submerged, like an enormous whale slipping backward into the water. The ship itself was on fire, but if that weren't bad enough, floating oil and diesel surrounded the rear portion in a wall of flames. Jayhawk Comms Center squawked over the radio. Rescue 6521, we're getting reports of a vessel fire off Pillar Point. Sloznik swung wide, flying slowly around the burning ship, assessing the situation. Crum craned her neck as they went around. I count 11 souls up on the forepeak, she said. At least 3 in the water, the flight mech said. 30 yards off the bow. I don't think they're in Gumby suits. Sloznik brought the Dolphin around for another pass, burning a few more pounds of fuel to give him hover time, while he briefed Jayhawk and requested more assets. Sloznik keyed the intercom. The 47 is still 22 minutes out. Lots of fire down there, Kitchen. How do you feel about going down in flames? The swimmer strained at his harness, wanting to get out of the helicopter. Looks good around the bow, boss, he said. I say we kick out our crew raft to give the survivors something to hang on to while I get started. Lieutenant Crum's voice came over the intercom. That ship's going down fast. 2 more just did a Peter Pan off the bow. The helicopter was finally light enough to hover within regs, so Sloznik reduced power, utilizing the wind as he descended toward the waves. Rain pelted the windscreen. The gale roared in as the flight mechanic slid open the side door. The rat out, radar altimeter alarm, sounded at 40 feet above the water. 12 to 16 foot waves and unpredictable winds kept him hovering there. The radios were blowing up with chatter from Jayhawk, Whidbey Island, and an assortment of responding surface vessels. Sloznik had chosen a lone survivor floundering a good 30 meters from the others on the port side of the vessel, reasoning that this one was alone and had probably been in the water longer than those who were grouped together. 90 seconds later, the flight mechanic lowered Kitchen down toward the surface on the hoist. The basket went down next and came up with a survivor, dazed and shaking but very much alive. Kitchen sent up 5 more, one after the other. The 47 arrived, but was soon busy at the wallowing stern, picking its way through floating containers and pools of fire. The Coast Guard boat crew had already pulled in 2 survivors and were heading toward a pocket of at least 2 more, who appeared to be stuck behind a wall of flaming diesel. Lieutenant Crum tapped the console. Commander, we're nearing bingo fuel. The MH-65 had a flight window of about 2 hours and 20 minutes, and a requirement that she come back with at least 20 minutes of reserve fuel. Pillar Point was slightly closer to Nia Bay to the west than it was to Port Angeles. Landing in Nia Bay for fuel would get the survivors on the ground for treatment sooner, extend Sloznik's available flight time by a precious few minutes, and get him back into action. He raised the rescue swimmer on the radio. We're packed to the gills up here, Sloznik said, looking out his window at Kitchen, who rode the frothy waves in the 70-mile-per-hour prop wash. The swimmer worked steadily to try to keep 10 survivors together around the small 6-person flight crew raft they'd kicked out of the helicopter. None of the survivors spoke English, and Sloznik was sure it was a lot like herding cats down there. You good to hold down the fort? We have to go and offload these survivors. Kitchen didn't hesitate. Roger that. We'll be here when you get back. Sloznik spoke into the radio as he added power, gaining altitude. Coast Guard Nia Bay, rescue 6521 heading to you with 6 survivors. The flight mech will fill you in on their condition. Break. Kitchen, you hold tight. We'll be back in a flash. Petty Officer Kitchen used the stiff jet fins to kick through the chop, directing the panicked seaman toward the crew raft he'd dropped out of the helicopter. The raft was meant for only 6 passengers, but Kitchen would stack them in like cordwood to await rescue from either the 47 boat from Nia Bay or 6521 when they returned. The bright yellow raft riding the waves should have been self-explanatory, but if Kitchen had learned anything about rescue operations, it was that cold and drowning men were unpredictable. He used hand signals and, when needed, physical force to direct the seamen. He'd already elbowed a particularly aggressive one in the solar plexus when the guy had tried to climb on top of him and use him as a human ladder to board the bobbing life raft. A couple of the men, one looked as if he was still a teenager, had the sense to hang on to the outer rings and direct their shipmates, calling out amid the wind and spray. Behind them, the mammoth ship groaned and hissed, shooting jets of spray into the air from every crack and ruptured seam as she slid deeper into the water. Kitchen could have imagined the 700 feet of blackness below him, the possibility of being crushed between half-submerged shipping containers that were tossed around in the mountainous waves. He could have focused on the fact that he was alone in the middle of an unforgiving sea, with 10 men who were about to claw one another's eyes out in an effort to keep from drowning. But he didn't. He was too busy. Chapter 5. Jack Ryan awoke at 4:51 a.m., a full 39 minutes before he got up on a normal day. But then, as President of the United States, normal was a subjective term. Kathy was out of town with the kids, performing cataract surgeries in Nepal. School wasn't exactly in full swing, but it had already started for the year, and Ryan wasn't too happy about Katie and Kyle missing the first few weeks. Katie had pointed out that while she fully agreed that school was important, a deep understanding of world culture was also crucial. Travel to Nepal, she reasoned, would add to that understanding in a way no classroom could. China canceled travel visas for people that wanted to go there, just to keep the Tibetans from sneaking into India, Dad. Don't you want me to visit some place the Chi-Coms say is off-limits? Ryan's wife bristled at the use of Chi-Coms, and he'd had to remind Katie it wasn't especially diplomatic for the president's daughter to use the word in reference to the communist Chinese, no matter what she might overhear him saying in the White House. His daughter's logic was sound and emotional, leaving Ryan to live in mortal fear that she would decide to be an attorney. So the kids went with Kathy to Nepal, and Jack Ryan found himself alone. He arched his back, ticking through the myriad old injuries that stitched his body. He had more than a few, and some woke up slower than others. Sitting up against his pillow, he glanced at the bedside table and the 5x7 photograph of his wife and him on the docks at Annapolis. They were standing with his old friend and mentor, the late Admiral James Greer. The photo customarily occupied a place of honor on top of his cherry wood dresser, but it was Ryan's favorite picture of Kathy, so he moved it to the side table whenever she went out of town. Ryan reached for his glasses and stood, wincing when his feet hit the carpet. He cast another glance at the photograph, getting a clearer view now. Jeez, his hair was so dark back then. That's just like you, Kathy, he mumbled, going off to restore poor people's vision when I need you here to rub my aching foot. With his wife performing medical miracles and no opportunity to engage in what the Secret Service euphemistically referred to as discussing the situation in Belgrade, Ryan was up and seated on the rowing machine in the residence gym by 5:05. An hour later found him showered and dressed in a pair of gray wool slacks and a white French cuffed shirt that had been laid out for him while he was in the gym. He left the blood-red power tie on the bed, preferring to wait until he finished breakfast before he consigned himself to the noose. The Navy steward, a young petty officer named Martinez, followed Ryan's location in the residence by watching a lighted panel that indicated POTUS's whereabouts as he moved across the pressure-sensitive pads under the carpet of the bedroom, gym, shower, and back to the bedroom. Accustomed to the president's schedule, the steward had breakfast ready on a side table in his study by the time he was dressed. The First Lady had given strict instructions to the White House chef that her husband's breakfasts should consist of oatmeal, skim milk and raisins during her absence. Ryan quickly countermanded that order, offering a presidential pardon to whatever punishments his wife might dole out if she ever discovered he was eating a buttered croissant and 2 poached eggs. Ryan spread the front page of the Wall Street Journal beside his plate on the white linen tablecloth. He'd heard it said that when it came to food, the eye ate first, but he'd always preferred to let his eyes work independently of his plate. He read, and hardly looked at his food, but to plot the correct aim with his fork. 20 minutes later, he carried the unfinished pages of the journal, along with the Post and the New York Times, to a more comfortable chair. He could have gone into the office, But when he went in, others thought they had to come in, and he saw no reason to get everyone else spun up just because his wife was in Nepal. Ahead of schedule, he allowed himself to linger a little over the papers and sip his coffee while he enjoyed some thinking time in the quiet of morning. In no time, things would speed up to their usual breakneck pace, and he would have to start making decisions. Wielding his cosmic power for good, his chief of staff would say. Ryan laughed at the thought. As a boy, growing up in the house with his policeman father, power had smelled like Hop's No. 9 gun oil and strong coffee. Here in the White House, it smelled like freshly pressed linen and strong coffee. Ryan glanced at his watch, then rationalized away 6 more minutes to limber his analytical mind on half the Wall Street Journal's crossword before digging into the presidential daily brief. The PDB was a collection of highly classified executive summaries that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence deemed worthy of his review. It contained everything from hard intelligence to rumors that, while patently false, were likely to incite unrest or instability in parts of the world where the United States had strategic or humanitarian interests. Charged with the deconfliction and information sharing between the 17 U.S. intelligence agencies, it was the responsibility of the ODNI to have a finger on the pulse of important world events, and to boil them down into the PDB. Ryan preferred a bluff report, bottom line up front. He wanted a simple executive summary of straight facts, even when those facts were about rumors, and would drill down on the specifics in face-to-face national security briefings. He'd cut his teeth in the intelligence community as an analyst, playing what-if games with world events, and could spend hours delving into the nuances of a single issue, and enjoying the hell out of it. But he wasn't in the rank and file of the IC anymore. The problems facing the office of president came at near lightning speed from all points of the compass, and at all hours of the day. Ryan was forced into the role of a generalist, relying on subject matter experts to work through the in-depth analysis and strategy. Theoretically, the PDB allowed him to stay a move or two ahead and decide where to put his pieces on the board. This morning's brief was straightforward, with the same parts of the world devolving into their continued spiral toward chaos, while other parts, admittedly fewer than he wished for, continued to emerge into newer, more robust economies. According to the briefing folder in front of him, the world was just as safe, or every bit as dangerous, as it had been the day before. At 7:40 a.m., Ryan snugged his red tie into a semi-uniform single Windsor and stuffed the PDB into the same leather briefcase he'd been carrying for years. He downed the last of his delicious Navy coffee, a phrase that did not come easily to the mind of a former Marine, and walked out of the West Sitting Hall to meet an earnest young Secret Service agent who was posted there. "Good morning, Tina," he said. Special Agent Tina Jordan gave him an exuberant smile, though she was coming to the end of her shift just as he was beginning his. "Good morning, Mr. President." Then, quietly, she raised her sleeve to her lips and whispered, "Swordsman is on the elevator." She stepped into a small alcove and pushed the button on the elevator that would take them down to the ground floor, where they hung a right to begin on Ryan's 3-minute walking commute to the office. Ryan entered the Oval from the Rose Garden, the door opened by the agent who knew how to overcome the security device in the handle. He found his daily calendar printed on a single sheet of paper that was centered perfectly on the middle of his desk, where his lead secretary had placed it shortly after she'd arrived at 7:30. Ryan pressed the intercom button on his phone. She already knew he was there because she, too, had a light board indicating his location. "Good morning, Betty."
"Good morning, Mr. President," his secretary said. "What can I do for you?"
"Director Foley and Secretary Adler should be here in a few minutes. Go ahead and send them in when they arrive."
"D&I Foley is here now, sir," Betty said.
A moment later, the Director of National Intelligence entered from the secretarial suite outside the Oval. Ryan had known Mary Pat and her husband Ed since their days at CIA together. They'd dodged innumerable crises, weathered the ones that were unavoidable, and together walked barefoot over the broken glass of some of the most tragic events in recent history. She was more than a member of his inner circle. She was a friend. And in Washington, friends were as rare as genuine statesmen. They saw each other at least 4 times a week, but Ryan still stood when she entered. He winced when he put weight on his foot, tried to hide it, and failed. Mary Pat gave him a narrow look. She opened her mouth to say something, but Scott Adler, the Secretary of State, came in, followed by Jay Canfield, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Arnie Van Dam, Ryan's chief of staff, entered from the adjoining door to his own office, the only person in the White House able to enter the Oval unseen and unimpeded. Arnie had served as chief of staff to 3 presidents. Ryan was the polar opposite of a politician, leaving Arnie to handle the annoying and frankly unfathomable part of the job that allowed him to get elected so he could make the decisions the country needed him to make. Jack picked his clubs and hit the ball, but Arnie told him the lay of the course. Ryan made his way to his favorite chair in front of the fireplace and waved the others to sit on either of the 2 off-white couches in the middle of the Oval Office. His advisors had all staked out their customary spots for these meetings long ago, and he felt sorry for anyone new to the cabinet who happened to take the wrong seat. The thought of it brought a smile to his face and a question to his mind. "Not national security related," he said, "but you guys have your ears to the ground out there more than I do. What do you hear about DeHart's nomination?" Ryan had recently put Mark DeHart, senior congressman from Pennsylvania, forward as his pick for Secretary of Homeland Security, an office recently vacated by the resignation of Andrew Zilko. Van Dam gave a slight shrug, the way he did when something was a non-issue. "That guy squeaks, he's so clean," he said. "Confirmation sounds like a foregone conclusion." The door opened again, and Bob Burgess, Secretary of Defense, stepped in. He scanned the seated group, checked his watch, and then shook his head. "I apologize for being only 5 minutes early, Mr. President." Ryan smiled, nodding to the Navy steward with the service cart rolling in behind Burgess. "You beat the coffee," he said. "That's something, I guess. We're just getting started." Ryan thanked the steward, who was already his co-conspirator in the less healthy breakfast scandal, and, as was his custom, poured everyone's coffee himself. Rather than standing, he simply held the cups out for his advisors to get up and take. No one appeared to mind. The meeting breezed along, hitting the high points about Russia, the Ukraine, immigration, and on the home front, the possibility that the Fed was going to raise interest rates. "And that brings us to the latest phone-op," Van Dam said. As COS, it was his job to keep the momentum going on the meeting, but always with an eye on his boss. FONOP was the acronym for Freedom of Navigation Operation. With China continuing to make what much of the world felt were absurd maritime claims in the South China Sea, the United States in general, and Ryan in particular, felt it important to show that not everyone agreed with those claims. To that end, several times each month, U.S. Navy vessels, typically destroyers or littoral combat ships, innocently sailed within the 12-mile line surrounding several of the disputed islands and reefs, without asking permission. The movements themselves had become almost commonplace. Within the last month, harassment by Chinese vessels and planes had reached new and alarming proportions. "Sounds like the PRC got their feelings especially hurt on this one," Ryan mused, perusing his written brief. The SecDef nodded. "That would be a correct assessment, Mr. President. LCS San Antonio sailed 11 miles off Woody Island in the Paracels on her way to Phuket, Thailand. As you know, the Chi-Coms have surface-to-air missiles on Woody, so the island is of particular interest to us. 2 J-10 fighters off the Woody airstrip buzzed the LCS 6 times. Commander Roger Reese, skipper of the San Antonio, reported encounters with multiple Chinese vessels, including a PLA Navy guided missile frigate that stayed on their tail all the way to the mouth of Patong Bay."
Reese followed international protocols, utilizing the code for unplanned encounters at sea, and hailed the ships to declare intentions and avoid miscommunications. Three large fish processors attempted a blockade, without a doubt at the behest of the PLA Navy. Commander Reese apparently plays a better game of chicken, and they eventually got out of the way. Ryan nodded. Good for Commander Reese. Burgess said CHICOMS accused him of illegal and dangerously provocative actions, as usual. I'm a little concerned about the optics on these phone ops, Sextate Adler said. Burgess suppressed a scoff, but just barely. The optics here are perfect, Scott. These patrols make it absolutely clear to the new Chinese president what the administration thinks of the great wall of sand he's continuing to dredge up. Ryan looked at the Secretary of State and shrugged. Bob's got a point, he said. Adler took a sip of his coffee and shook his head. Don't misunderstand me, sir. I'm referring to the optics presented to the Chinese public, not President Zhou and the party mandarins. Pun intended, Ryan said, arms crossed, chin on his fist. Absolutely, Mr. President. Adler grinned. He, too, had been with Ryan since the beginning, and his opinion was invaluable, even when Ryan didn't agree with it, often for that very reason. But in all seriousness, Adler said, it's a brave new world out there. Everyone with a smartphone is an on-the-scene reporter. The Communist Party of China has worked very hard to gain back the hearts of the population after President Wei lost control and killed himself before he could be arrested. They're doing that by whipping up a nationalist fervor. Xinhua is running multiple stories this morning about the illegal encroachment of American warships into their waters over which China has indisputable sovereignty, complete with photographs of the San Antonio that were presumably taken from the Chinese guided missile frigate. Mary Pat raised her pen and conceded the Secretary of State's point. Weibo is abuzz with nationalist fervor. Ryan mulled that over, but said nothing. State-controlled, Xinhua News ran nothing that was not filtered and approved by the Communist Party. Weibo was the microblogging site that was the Chinese answer to Twitter. DCIA Jay Canfield added, "There are more than a few folks in the microblogosphere calling our actions nothing less than an act of war." "That's not unusual," Burgess said. 99.99% of those buzzing voices are no doubt spewing forth from columns of terabyte warriors, marching in lockstep in some information warfare battalion or 50-cent army in a Beijing warehouse, or working directly for Ministry of State Security. In any case, this nationalism is likely voiced by the same government propaganda machine that submits stories to Xinhua. As you just pointed out, it wasn't too long ago that a large part of the PRC's population was so fed up with the Communist Party that they threatened to storm the Zhongnanhai and drag their bastard leaders to the guillotine. Mary Pat raised an eyebrow. The guillotine? Burgess shrugged, but held his ground. The sword, the firing squad. You know what I mean. Ryan sighed. President Zhou's relatively new, but my read is that he's made of much tougher stuff than Wei ever was. He's a princeling, and with that comes a certain amount of old guard support among the Central Committee. He appears to be using that support to gobble up power like Pac-Man, all while he sees to the rebuilding of national pride, along with the thousands of acres of new islands in the SCS. People can be fed up with the party, and still have a hell of a lot of contempt for us. True enough, the Secretary of State said. I'm just saying that it's one thing for the party to know you mean business, but the broad media coverage of our warships sailing through what the average Chinese citizen views as their waters could force President Zhou to respond. He can't afford to appear to be letting his power slip. As Bob says, Zhongnanhai leadership knows all too well what happens if the masses smell blood in the water. I'm in no way suggesting that freedom of navigation exercises are a bad thing, but the optics are something to be aware of. Interesting stuff, Ryan said, but nothing here is surprising. Maybe this phone up will be nothing more than a little bump under the tires of our week. Mary Pat scoffed. I'm sorry, sir, she said, but did I ever tell you about the tiny little tick bite that put me in the hospital for a week when I was 10 years old? She pulled back the collar of her silk blouse to reveal a dime-sized scar on her neck. Sometimes, it's the little things that scare me the most. There's that old Chinese curse, Burgess said. May you live in interesting times. Ryan sat back in his chair. I think Bobby Kennedy just made that one up. Burgess started to add something, but Ryan said, optics noted. He was ready to move on. Scott put together the usual statement reiterating our position that the U.S. Navy and U.S. merchant ships have been operating freely in the South China Sea for many decades, and we don't intend to leave anytime soon. Note that LCS San Antonio was on an innocent and routine mission to visit our friends in Thailand, and have someone leak informally to the Chinese ambassador that I'm pretty pissed about the way they hid behind a bunch of innocent fishermen and put them in danger. Adler made a note in his folio. Yes, Mr. President. Ryan looked at the DNI. Her lips were pursed in thought, eyes twinkling and narrow. They'd worked together long enough that he knew when she was chewing on something that might interest him. He prodded. What is it, Mary Pat? She gave an almost imperceptible nod, as if still working through a thought. A game of chicken only works if neither party knows when the other will flinch, she said. It wasn't too many months ago that you demonstrated to China that you were willing to, excuse me, but there's no other way to say it, bomb the shit out of them. It was only a building that time, but you've made your resolve crystal clear. An increase in hostilities, even to bolster nationalism, is incredibly dangerous. All due respect, Mr. President, but playing chicken with you is akin to driving into a brick wall. Stupid men do not become the paramount leader of the People's Republic of China. President Zhou has to know that you will not get out of the way. Adler looked up from his notes. Are you saying Zhou is knowingly trying to foment an actual shooting war? The DNI shook her head. I'm saying there's something strange going on in the PRC. I can't put my finger on it, but it is strange. Ryan paused for a moment, eyes fixed on the Remington bronze beyond his desk. The others in the room knew when he was thinking, and they gave him the space to do so by looking down at the folios in their laps and keeping quiet. Mary Pat was right. He'd never been much of a yielder when it came to games of chicken. Now, though, he played the game with other people's kids. It didn't necessarily mean he was more likely to flinch. It did, however, make him careful never to start such a game himself. Scott, he said, get on the horn with your counterparts in and around Southeast Asia over the next few days. You can start with Australia and Japan. They certainly have big dogs in this fight over the SCS. Let them know we appreciate what they are doing, but it wouldn't hurt our feelings if they ramped up their own movements in these waters. They don't have to go out of their way to piss off the Chinese, but they shouldn't be tippy-toeing around to avoid them either. A unified front, Secretary Burgess said. Wouldn't that be nice? Yes, it would, the President said, and I'll do my part by bringing up the issue during bilateral meetings while we're in Tokyo. He eyed Van Damme over his glasses. I do have meetings with both the Japanese and Australian PMs, right? You do, the COS said. Ryan looked forward to the G20 summit. It was supposed to be about the economy. What wasn't, after all? But world leaders, being who they were, discussed whatever they damn well pleased when they got together. Ryan enjoyed the face-to-face meetings. Statesmanship between leaders with competing agendas was often sorely lacking, even in his own country. Hell, especially in his own country. Van Damme flipped through several pages in his folder. The final advance team is in Tokyo now. Last-minute changes will be doable, of course, especially if you and State need any follow-on talks with Australia and Japan. But the Secret Service won't be too keen on it. I'm pretty sure they'd just as soon drive you around Tokyo in an Abrams tank. The White House advance office went out at least 3 times before any presidential travel, such as to the G20. The first trip,
5 months prior to the event, was called the survey. The second, known as a pre-advance, occurred a month or so before the actual event. A final advance took place 3 weeks later, a week prior to the president's arrival. By pre-advance time, the big hurdles, such as where they would park the 19 aircraft and hundreds of vehicles, had all been roughed out, allowing the advance team to drill down on the inevitable crisis issues that always came up. "And don't forget the PRC," Ryan said, nodding. "I want to sit down face to face with President Joe at least once. Maybe keep this game of chicken from progressing any further. It would be nice if I could point out our unified front with—" Betty's voice came over the intercom, cutting him off. "Mr. President," she said, "I'm sorry to interrupt you, but Commander Forrestal is here. He says it's urgent." Interruptions like this were not uncommon. When not in the Oval Office, every person in the room was tied to a government-issue BlackBerry or iPhone. The intelligence umbilicus, Mary Pat called it. But each of them left their smartphone in a basket at the secretary's desk just outside before entering the Oval. There were secure phones in compartments inside the Oval Office furniture if anyone needed to make a call pursuant to a meeting. Betty had a copy of the president's calendar. She knew how long his appointments were scheduled to last, and her ability to ascertain if some issue just absolutely could not wait bordered on a superpower. Chapter 6 Commander Robbie Forrestal stepped into the Oval a moment later, standing by the door until the president motioned him the rest of the way in. Bald as an egg, he had an angular jaw and runner's build that suited his Navy service dress whites, the summer uniform he'd wear through September. The placard of ribbons on his chest said he'd served in conflicts involving Afghanistan, Iran, and China. It never ceased to move Ryan how much time in action these young servicemen now faced before they were 35. It was a sobering thought, since for too many years it had been a nod from him that sent them there. 3 minutes later, Commander Forrestal finished his initial bottom-line up-front briefing regarding the explosion and eventual sinking of China Global Shipping Lines Orion. He took a step back, waiting for discussion and questions. As a former national security advisor himself, Ryan knew how to conduct a briefing, and Forrestal was one of the best. "Casualties?" Ryan asked. "Preliminary information reports 4 dead," Forrestal said, "but the ship's manifest says there were 32 souls on board, and only 22 of those were accounted for." Ryan took a long breath and gave a pensive shake of his head. 6 more. "Still missing, Mr. President," Forrestal said. "Coast Guard has a Mandarin speaker from Seattle on scene at the command post now. I'll have more information for you in short order." Ryan read the 1-page executive summary Commander Forrestal had provided. 40-knot winds and 16-foot seas. "Yes, sir," Forrestal said. "We're fortunate they were able to save the 22, considering the conditions. The search for the 6 missing crewmen is still ongoing. I have to admit, the Coasties are doing an incredible job here." "High praise from a Navy man." Ryan smiled. "So they're diverting traffic up through Canada?" "Yes, sir," Forrestal said. "The strait is 20 miles wide at some points, but given the weather, it's impossible to tell how many containers are floating around beneath the surface. One of the Coast Guard 45s out of Port Angeles has already hit one. The crew is okay, but their vessel is inop." Ryan checked his watch. "It'll be getting light out there by now at this time of year. That'll help. But I'd imagine it's a circus. A ship that large, there's bound to be a lot of oil and diesel floating around." "True enough, Mr. President," Forrestal said. "The district captain has raised the MARSEC level and instituted a standoff zone. If there's anything good about the weather, it's that most of the looky-loos are staying off the water. EPA officials out of Seattle are on scene. We should have the preliminary environmental assessment any time." "As bad as the weather is, it would be nothing for a modern container ship to negotiate." Ryan tapped the paper with his forefinger to underscore his point. "What caused this ship to sink?" "According to the Mandarin speaker, the crewmen are claiming a series of explosions." "Burgess couldn't contain himself." "In the engine room?" "That's unknown," Forrestal said, before turning back to Ryan.
Nothing but wags so far, Mr. President.
Commander Forrestal had been around long enough to know that Ryan had enough information flying across his desk. He didn't have time for wild-ass guesses.
Very well, Ryan said. Keep us informed.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Forrestal turned to go, but Ryan stopped him, calling him by his first name to take the tone of the meeting down a notch.
Thank you, Robbie, the President said. Didn't your son have a football game last weekend?
The commander smiled.
He did, sir. Ran for a total of 64 yards.
Not bad for an 11-year-old in Pop Warner, Ryan said. Be careful. The Patriot scouts will be looking at him before he knows it.
I'll tell him you said that, sir, Forrestal said, excusing himself with a broad grin.
Not everyone got to pass on kudos to their kid from the President of the United States.
Ryan turned back to his advisors once the door was shut.
A bomb? Secretary Burgess said. Diesel engines don't usually explode.
Scott Adler gave a slow shake of his head.
That's one possibility, he said.
The explosion could very easily have been a reaction of some chemicals in one of the containers. We'll have to look at the manifest. In any case, this incident creates another problem that piles onto the issues I mentioned regarding the phone op. I'm happy the Coast Guard was so quick to respond, but our rescue of 22 Chinese seamen is just another thing to make President Zhou look weak. His ships can't even make it to Seattle without the evil capitalists lending a hand.
You know, Mary Pat said, nodding, it's a poor state of affairs, but he's right.
Maybe, Ryan said. All of you get into this and see what you can find out regarding terror threats toward Chinese shipping.
And specific threats toward us from the Chi-Coms, Burgess added.
That too, Bob, Ryan said, although I sincerely hope any specific threats would have floated to the top already.
Ryan stood to show the briefing was at an end. He was careful not to put any weight on his heel.
Ryan waited for everyone, including Arnie Van Dam, to file out and their respective doors to close behind them before he hobbled toward his desk. He'd nearly made it when Mary Pat stuck her head back inside.
I saw you limping, Jack, she said, affecting the motherly voice she'd used on him when they were in the CIA together. MP was an extremely close cohort who still addressed him by his given name, but even she rarely did it in the Oval Office. She opened her hand to reveal a golf ball with the presidential seal in her open palm. I got this from the stash of tchotchkes Betty gives out to visitors when they can't get in to see you. Ed had a bout with plantar fasciitis a couple of years ago. It's nothing to be ashamed of.
Ryan leaned back in his chair, eyebrows raised.
Getting old isn't for wusses, he said.
You're not a wuss, Mary Pat said. You're an invalid.
Ryan sighed again.
Yeah, well, don't spread that around. Press gets word I have a toothache and the market's dropped 50 points.
I will treat your condition as highly classified, Mary Pat said, and then tossed him the ball. You're supposed to take off your shoe and roll this around under the arch of your foot. It works wonders.
Ryan looked back and forth from the golf ball to his aching foot.
Well, Mary Pat said, glancing at her watch, my boss expects me to get some work done today. I'll leave you to your rehab.
Alone again, Ryan glanced at the paper copy of his schedule on the center of his desk. It was not uncommon for the document to be vague, as the president's daily schedule was posted on a White House website. Betty or Arnie usually added a little handwritten commentary for him in the margins of his copy. This morning, his 9 o'clock simply said, meeting. He'd just pressed his intercom when the door opened and his secretary stuck her head in. The woman's prescience really did border on a superpower.
What's next, Betty?
Special Agent Montgomery, Mr. President. The new special agent in charge of your protection detail. He asked for 5 minutes to introduce himself.
Grouchy from the pain in his heel, Ryan dropped the golf ball on the carpet and began to roll it around under his foot.
I liked Joe, he muttered. We got along well. He was good at his job. Why couldn't they just leave me Joe?
Ryan glanced up at his secretary's passive face. It was the closest she would ever come to chastising him, even when he deserved it.
Lovely dress, Betty, he said, by way of apology for his sulking.
Thank you, Mr. President, she said.
Special Agent O'Hearn will do a fine job as deputy director. She raised her eyebrows and tilted her head like a mom, telling him to give the liver and onions a chance. This Montgomery fellow seems like a very nice man.
Send him in, Ryan said.
Betty placed a file folder in the center of Ryan's desk and excused herself with a benign smile. Prepared by the Secret Service.